Because of a state law, people in Ohio can sometimes have very little say about whether a gas company can frack beneath their property, or about what that might mean for their water supply.
You know, we would express our environmental concerns. That was never addressed. The only thing that they could offer us was money.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, when landowners are forced into fracking and fear for their water and their way of life. Plus, if Lyme disease goes untreated, the consequences can be debilitating and expensive.
It's north of $50,000, which isn't really from a, you know, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
And a four-day kayak trip leaves a lot of time for contemplation.
Most of us lead our lives and never really think about the rivers, but the river's such a big part of the ecosystem.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The Trump administration has rolled back one of President Obama's signature climate policies designed to cut coal emissions. The new rule would help struggling coal power plants remain open. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports it also will hurt efforts to cut carbon emissions.
Obama's Clean Power Plan set national carbon emission standards. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler says the replacement, known as the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, gives that power to the states.
That means cleaner and more affordable energy for the American public.
Pennsylvania is the third largest coal-producing state in the country. But coal-generated electricity plants have struggled to compete with cheaper natural gas and renewables. Coal-burning power plants are a major cause of global warming. Clean Air Council Executive Director Joe Minot says the move will not only slow progress on reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
And also more particulate pollutant and sulfur dioxide and pollutants that will have a more immediate effect on people's health.
The Trump administration rule is expected to face court challenges. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
While the climate is on the back burner when it comes to energy policy on the federal level, discussions over how to address climate change appear to be heating up in Harrisburg. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more on two efforts to limit greenhouse gas emissions.
Governor Tom Wolf is negotiating with Republicans in the legislature to include language in this year's budget that will allow Pennsylvania to join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, a collaboration among northeastern states to reduce harmful emissions. Separately, the State Department of Environmental Protection is reviewing a citizen-led climate petition that would create an economy-wide cap-and-trade system in Pennsylvania. Cap-and-trade is a market-based way to cut emissions by requiring polluters to pay for them. DEP Secretary Patrick McDonnell says climate change is the biggest issue facing the state.
Going through this petition process is one of the components that we're taking very seriously in evaluating how we address climate change going forward.
Scientists say governments around the world need to quickly and dramatically cut greenhouse gas emissions to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, a threshold seen as necessary to avoid the worst effects of climate change, including extreme weather, droughts, and food shortages. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This summer, we're examining what happens when gas companies impact local communities in Ohio. In our latest story in the series, Who's Listening?, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant takes a closer look at an Ohio law that can force landowners to lease their underground mineral rights to energy companies.
In 2010, a landman from an energy company knocked on Patrick Hunkler and his wife Jean Bax's door, and it changed their lives.
Well, you know, I didn't know much about fracking.
He offered them $137 an acre for the mineral rights under their 21 acres in Belmont County in eastern Ohio.
$137, that's probably the closest I ever came to signing a lease at $137.
By 2014, they were being offered $8,500 an acre. Jean Bax was getting ready to retire after 30 years working for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, and the money might have been nice, but...
No, I would have preferred to not sign a lease.
They'd heard about water and air pollution from well pads, compressor stations, and waste injection wells. In the woods around their house, they clear the leaves from the top of a buried tank and pull off the lid. It collects spring water that's pumped to the house. Hunkler worries that if a well is fracked nearby, the chemical-laced water used in that process could escape the concrete well casing and contaminate his spring water.
Concrete, my concrete sidewalk fails sometimes, so I don't see why concrete casing couldn't fail also.
And Bax worries about the millions of gallons of water used to frack each well and the waste it creates.
Where is that water going to come from, and then what will happen to it when they're finished? And you can't know that at the time that you sign a lease.
But still, her husband, who'd built a solar-powered house with recycled materials, was open to the idea.
I would have signed a lease had I gotten a lot of environmental stipulations.
They say they were inundated with more than 100 calls to lease their land in just a few years.
You know, we would express our environmental concerns and, hey, we'd like this in lease. That was never addressed. The only thing that they could offer us was money.
But making money wasn't as important to this family as protecting their environment. They say landmen called them foolish and went as far as following them on vacation, even threatening to bring the sheriff over to force them to sign.
I felt harassed.
Then in 2017, they got a notice from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, or ODNR. Chesapeake Energy was seeking to unitize their property. That meant the state could force the family to sign a lease under state law. Heidi Robertson is a professor of law and environmental studies at Cleveland State University.
We normally think of the rights of the landowner as being things like the right to decide what's done with your land or what's not done with your land.
But Robertson says that's not necessarily the case in Ohio when it comes to drilling for oil and natural gas. That's because the state adopted what's known as a unitization law in 1965, with requirements for the size and shape of land where a well can be drilled, known as a unit. According to industry experts, surface units in Ohio today usually range from 300 to 1,100 acres. And Robertson says one unit of land can have hundreds of different landowners.
Then you have to have the agreement of all of the landowners in order to cobble together the rights to drill.
She says the problem for energy companies like Chesapeake and for people who want to lease their land comes when other landowners in the unit, like Patrick Hunkler and Gene Bax, say no to drilling.
It's almost like a veto, a single landowner being able to veto the ability of all the surrounding landowners to drill.
And to make money from the oil and gas. In Ohio, if a company gets 65% of landowners in a unit to agree to lease their mineral rights, it can use that unitization law to force unwilling landowners into leases. Energy companies offer upfront bonus payments and royalties as a carrot to get landowners to sign leases. Robertson says unitization laws also give the company's landmen a stick.
They come in and say things like, well, we're offering you X amount of money. And they'll, in fact, say, if you refuse to, quote, volunteer, you'll be forced through this administrative process through the state, and it will cost you more.
There's only one recorded case of the unitization process in Ohio, according to experts. That is, until the fracking boom. Since 2011, the chief of ODNR's Division of Oil and Gas Resources Management has approved 144 forced leases, or unitizations, through a hearing in Columbus, like this one.
A hearing before the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas.
This is not the Hunkler's case, but it's similar. This time, Ascent Resources has brought a geologist, an engineer, and a landman to testify along with a slew of attorneys. The landman details efforts to locate unleased landowners and get them to sign. The company engineer testifies that Ascent's project is a $20 million investment. He says without the unleased tracts of land, the company would lose the ability to collect so much gas that the project would no longer be financially viable.
Yes, that would be the difference likely in what would be a project that Ascent Resources would pursue versus what we would not pursue.
This is the basis of whether ODNR issues a unitization order and forces holdout landowners to lease with the company, the profitability of the project. At Chesapeake's unitization hearings against his family, Patrick Hunkler asked the state to also consider environmental concerns. But the Ohio Department of Natural Resources told him they had no authority to do that.
Hey, ODNR, we have concerns about our natural resources. Who can we talk to? They didn't listen to us in the hearing.
Hunkler says when they tried to defend their property rights based on the state standard, profitability for the company, it wasn't clear where Chesapeake got its numbers. Chesapeake declined an interview. So did the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. Hunkler's attorney, Megan Hunter, says the process is stacked against landowners who don't want to lease. The state has never ruled against an energy company in a unitization hearing.
One side is really well represented, and the government is often aligned with them in these administrative forums, and the citizen is left to fend for themselves.
ODNR did issue orders for Chesapeake to unitize Hunkler's property, but after constructing the well pad nearby, the company abruptly sold all its Ohio assets. The family was told the unitizations had been dissolved. Now they, along with their neighbors, are left wondering what will happen with the next energy company. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Our series about fracking in Ohio is supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the Sear Sweatland Family Foundation. For all of our stories in the series, go to AlleghenyFront.org/who's listening. Next week, we'll look at how Ohio residents used the Clean Water Act to counter what they say was inaction from state regulators to keep fracking waste out of water. The symptoms of later stage Lyme disease are scary and can look like a lot of other health issues.
Dementia-type symptoms. It was forgetting how to go places that I'd been to 100 times.
Later on the Allegheny Front, a push to get health insurers to cover treatments for advanced Lyme disease. Stay tuned. The Stony Kiski Kanama River Sojourn is an annual event which features a colorful parade of kayaks and canoes. The four-day, 44-mile journey is sponsored by the Kanama Valley Conservancy in order to heighten awareness and inspire appreciation for local rivers, especially this network of waterways east of Pittsburgh. From Johnstown to Apollo, the group paddles through deep river gorges, a few Class II rapids, and historic towns like Salzburg and Blairsville. They camp each night along the way. About 30 paddlers make the whole trip, and another 50 or so join up for one or more days. Andy Cubis joined the Sojourners on their last day, amid the sounds of cicadas and breakfast.
Wait a minute, I'm sausage but not. I'm up to finishing my delicious breakfast that they brought. My name is Rosemarie Stover. I am on the Stony Kanama Kiski Sojourn.
20th annual.
20th annual, yes. I come on this. I've probably been on it 6 years now, and I come. I love the people, the river. I grew up in New Kensington, and so this is kind of brings me back home again. It's going to be a gorgeous day.
Where's our bus?
We're catching the shuttle bus to go back to Avonmore so that we can start the paddling part of the trip.
Anybody has not signed the boat manifest, please come over and see.
Oh, I should.
Today we are traveling from Avonmore to Roaring Run, 7 miles. There are some shallow ripples, occasional standing waves, easily avoidable.
My name is Brooke Handley, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and this is my first sojourn ever. It's even more than what I expected. I told everybody I kind of feel like I've been at summer camp for the past 4 days, which is awesome.
You ready?
Yep.
Okay, here you go.
Go, go. Ooh, that's cold. First day I dumped out, which is okay. But every other day, knock on wood, I haven't dumped out. So I'm learning as I'm going how to navigate things. And I've gotten a lot of great advice from all of the veteran paddlers. So learning a lot.
I'm Amanda Wareham. I am from the Pittsburgh area. I have the orange, green, yellow kayak, and they said, I'll just call it a Skittle. And when I bought it, I said, oh, it kind of looks like a lifesaver. So it, for me, it was high visibility, but the other option was pink, and I didn't want a pink one. Most of us lead our lives and never really think about the rivers, but the river's such a big part of the ecosystem, and part of what we've done each evening is to have some educational sessions, and they've talked about in the last 30 years really how the river life has been revitalized because, you know, primarily mining is what has really knocked out, and you can still see signs of it. There are some areas where you can come down and you can see the runoff where you can tell that it's iron ore and things like that. So it's a neat area where we got the chance to learn about it as well.
Looks like rapids.
So my name's Laura Hawkins. I am what's called a Greenway Coordinator for something called the Pittsburgh to Harrisburg Mainline Canal Greenway. This Kiskeconomaw River system is sort of infamous. This is the path of the Johnstown flood. The Kiske River is the largest tributary into the Allegheny River. So what happens up here affects everything downstream and all of the Pittsburgh rivers.
My name is Mark Shank. I'm from Blairsville. So I'm a local from around here. And first time I ever come down the river, the Conemaugh River through the Pack Saddle Gap, I was 16 years old. And the water was pure orange.
Excuse us.
So if you had anything white on, your parents knew where you were. And it's so nice now that the river's cleaned up. We got fish in it, it's good fishing, and wonderful recreation.
A little bit of water in there, kind of heavy.
You're taking some of the water home as a souvenir?
Yes, sir.
Andy Cube has produced that audio postcard for us, and you also heard from Richard Bloom and Mike Burke. There are photos from the trip earlier this month at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. As you've heard, acid mine drainage, or AMD, plagues the Kiskeconomaw watershed. Streams and rivers turn orange and are essentially dead. Nothing can live in them. That's not unusual in western Pennsylvania. There are numerous efforts to clean up these discharges of metals that seep from old underground coal mines.
So there's somewhere in the ballpark of 5,580 AMD impacted miles of stream in the state, and somewhere in the ballpark of 190,000 acres of unreclaimed mine sites as well.
I talked by phone with Brandon Deal, grants and project consultant at the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, about a new project to improve the water quality on the Little Conemaugh River, which starts in Cambria County and is a tributary of the Conemaugh. So how polluted is the Little Conemaugh and the Kiskeconomaw watershed?
In large part, those areas are non-attaining their Chapter 93 designations. And that's just a really scientific and regulatory way of saying those streams are not allowing for aquatic organisms to live in them, or they're not meeting the standards for a cold water fishery or a warm water fishery. I'd say 90% of that area of the Little Conemaugh fits into that category. There are 7 discharges that account for about 80% of that pollution, and that's really what we're sort of focused on. Now, business and industry has treated the largest source of that contamination, and that was Rosebud Mining by treating the St. Michael discharge. You know, that was accounting for, and depending on which study you look at, between 29 and 33% of the metal loadings into the Little Conemaugh on a daily basis. That has been treated now. That's improved water quality 10 miles down from that location in St. Michael to the little borough of Mineral Point.
So the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds is now looking to clean up 3 discharges into the Little Conemaugh with this special project. Talk about how the new project will treat acid mine drainage and how it's different from other AMD cleanup projects.
So in 2008, there was a report that was created by the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation and the Cambria County Conservation District. That report was labeled the Super 7 Strategy. It outlined 7 different discharges within the Little Conemaugh that needed to be treated in order to get comprehensive restoration. The thought was refocusing on that study and that list of 7 discharges to see if there was some technology changes or a different strategy that could be executed to get restoration within the Little Conemaugh without perhaps treating all 7 of those. So working with the Federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement, and we did some work that digitized underground mine maps, used some GIS software to see how those maps and mines lay in space under the ground, and then used some expertise from their hydrogeologists to see if there was a way that we could connect underground mine pools underground without having to treat them at a single point and location. And that's really what we're working on now. So in the area of Portage Borough in Cambria County, we're working on designing a plant that would look and operate much like the plant does in St. Michael that's owned and operated by Rosebud Mining. But this plant would be owned and operated by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's Bureau for Abandoned Mine Reclamation. And it would be an active treatment plant, meaning that there would be a mechanical process where alkaline material would be added to the water that comes out of these discharges. It would be aerated, chemically stirred, the iron and heavy metals would fall out of that. That sludge material would go back into the mine pools, and we would discharge clean water. And people might ask, what's the benefit of that? So that plant is expected to bring back 12 miles of biologically dead stream and enhance water quality for an additional 15 miles downstream. It allows us to sort of pick an area where we can develop a treatment system that will address these three discharges and not necessarily have to be constrained by space.
Deal says optimistically the project will be up and running in 2025 and will cost more than $21 million to complete. The money will come from the foundation, which was the beneficiary of funds from a Clean Water Act violation by a power company, the state capital budget, and from the Abandoned Mine Lands Fund, which is federal money from a fee collected on extracted coal. Brandon Deal is the grants and project consultant for the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, which has supported the Allegheny Front. You can listen to a previous Allegheny Front story about the Rosebud Mine, as well as learn more about this AMD treatment project at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Hulsoppel. Last year, Pennsylvania led the nation with cases of Lyme disease, more than 10,000. For many, Lyme can be knocked out quickly with a course of antibiotics. But when Lyme disease goes untreated, it can have devastating consequences. Transforming Health's Brett Schultes shares the story of a man who's part of a group hoping to change how insurers are covering the disease.
With the sun shining and birds chirping on a warm spring day, it's easy to see why Anson Flake loves living at the edge of the woods in Enola.
It was at the time, you know, a dream to have a house in the woods, and it still is. I love it. But, you know, as we'll talk about, there's a lot of ticks out here.
Anson never expected one of those ticks would lead him to the state capitol in support of a piece of legislation, but at some point in the early 2000s, he contracted Lyme disease.
I don't know if I got it here on the property, because we used to play paintball a lot, or if I got it on a hike. I used to hike a lot.
Flake found out he had it the hard way. He was on a sales call in Texas when he got a pounding headache.
The guy that I was meeting with said, "Hey, you're not looking so good." I said, I'm feeling terrible.
He had meningitis, a rare complication of late-stage Lyme. A doctor's quick response helped to save his life, and the meningitis was cured. But Flake says because he went so long without treatment, he had what doctors call late-stage Lyme encephalopathy. Some of the symptoms were terrifying.
Dementia-type symptoms. It was forgetting how to go places that I'd been to 100 times.
It took years to be cured, and while today the 53-year-old says he feels great, because insurance only covered a few weeks of antibiotics, he says it took a lot of his own money to get better.
It's north of $50,000, which isn't really from a, you know, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
Flake is part of a group pushing for House Bill 629 that would require health insurers to cover whatever the doctor prescribes, including long-term antibiotic treatment. And this is where his cause hits head-on into some controversial questions about Lyme disease. Do some people continue to be sick after getting treatment? Do some people need more than 3 or 4 weeks of antibiotics? That all depends on who you ask.
They get involved, they go up a blind alley.
Philip Baker is executive director of the nonprofit American Lyme Disease Foundation. He says, basically, chronic Lyme disease, as some people call it, doesn't exist. He says there's no proof that people who develop chronic symptoms have Lyme, and no proof that more antibiotics will help.
So what's the reaction? They'll say, well, I'm convinced that I have Lyme disease. The tests are no good. I'll keep going from doctor to doctor until I find somebody that will tell me I have Lyme disease. It's like a cult in a way.
Baker notes 3 National Institutes of Health studies did find a severe impairment in health and quality of life among people reporting Lyme symptoms after getting treatments, but results showed no benefit to prolonged antibiotic therapy. Lorraine Johnson says 3 studies aren't enough.
When you close the book and say the science is settled, we know exactly how you should treat this disease within these parameters and no variation, you really ought to have a strong body of evidence behind you, but that hasn't been developed in Lyme disease. So right.
Johnson
now,
is CEO of nonprofit LymeDisease.org, which advocates for people who say they have Lyme disease that hasn't responded to the standard treatment. Her group wants the NIH to do more studies, something she says needs to happen fast, because recent research suggests undiagnosed Lyme is much more commonplace than once believed. Seated in a reclining chair in his backyard, Anson Flake notes House Bill 629 passed the House and currently sits in the Senate Insurance and Banking Committee, where past versions of this bill have all stalled. But Flake says this year could be different. A lot of other states have adopted similar bills.
And they haven't seen a negative financial impact to the insurance industry.
And there's a new committee chair, Republican State Senator Mario Scavello of Monroe County, who supports a similar effort in the Senate.
What we'd love to see is give the healthcare practitioner the ability to make the decision on, does the patient need long-term antibiotics or not?
As scientists research Lyme, the debate likely won't end whether the bill passes or not. With insurance companies and doctors each having a stake in the matter, it's an issue that will continue to play out in the state capitol and in doctors' offices around the Commonwealth. In Enola, Cumberland County, I'm Brett Schultes.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. Those episodes are at trumponearth.org. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.